This is Judaism Unbound, episode 80, Feeling the Burn. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today for one of our discussion episodes, which means we want to open with a few announcements. One announcement that I'm particularly excited about is that Judaism Unbound is now available on Alexa. That's that Amazon device that I won't speak her name too much because she might respond to it if this is on speaker in somebody's house. But that Amazon device that you can talk to, you can now ask it to play the latest episode of Judaism Unbound. And it's using an app called TuneIn, which you can also access through your phone or wherever. But we're really excited that now when you're cooking dinner, maybe cooking Shabbat dinner, you can just ask Alexa for the most recent episode of Judaism Unbound. And we do come out on Friday, so it would be especially useful perhaps for people that are making challah or something like that. So we're really excited about that. So our other announcements are, we want to remind you that we're publishing transcripts of Judaism Unbound. We had a little bit of a lull in getting them out, but now we're getting them out again, and we're going to try to get them up in order of release. So you should be able to start to look at our website and find transcripts for our earlier episodes, and we hope to get those up relatively quickly for you in case there are people out there who prefer reading to listening.
And also, we're excited for accessibility reasons for those who, not just from a preference place, but who aren't able to access us through audio for us to open up to another audience of people who are able to read but not hear from us. So we're excited about that.
Very true. And we also just wanted to remind you of the usual things that we remind you of in these discussion episodes, that there are a variety of ways that you can help us if you're finding these conversations are helping you. The first way that you can help us is to make a financial donation. There are a variety of ways for you to do that. Go to our website at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. And you can see the various ways that you can do that. We are thrilled to have large donations, but we also want to remind you that we have a variety of ways, including our account at Patreon, to make a small monthly donation. And while $1 a month, $5 a month may not seem like a lot to you, it actually adds up a lot for us and really helps us continue this work. I want to remind everybody that we are a nonprofit organization, so any donations that you do make to us are fully tax deductible to the extent of the law. I'd also like to ask you to leave us a positive review and a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever else you're able to rate the podcast. Those search algorithms help other people find the podcast. And really, it's been thanks to those of you who have made positive recommendations, both in person and on iTunes and other podcatchers, that has allowed us to grow so much in our listenership. It's really incredible to see how those numbers grow. And we really thank you for doing that. And the last way that you can really help us is with your skills. We are really eager to do all kinds of things that we don't have the time and skills to do. If you're out there and you have skills in the realms of web development, app development, transcript creation, graphic design, all kinds of anything that you think that we need, we probably agree and just don't have the skills to do it. We have a very...
So many skills we don't have.
We're very modest in our skills. Largely, they include talking, and that's about it. So if you can help us, we would love to have your help. And please just send us an email either at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And now let's jump into our show where we're discussing the last two interviews that we had, the first one with John Mitchell and Ali Wollner, and the second one with Joel Stanley about Burning Man. And Lex, I'll just remind everyone that the way that this really came up was that I was really struck when I was out in Silicon Valley at the JCC in Silicon Valley, which has been an amazing partner for us. And I was talking to people, and you know, so many people were heading off to Burning Man. This was about a year ago. Actually, Burning Man is coming up this very week, I believe, or maybe next week. So for all those of you who are listening and are about to head off to Burning Man, I don't know what the right, you know, blessing for you is, but would like to offer it. You know, it's one of those things where when you hear about something, all of a sudden you're hearing about it everywhere. And I started to run into other people in Chicago and elsewhere that were also Burning Man people. And in fact, I started to talk to some folks who are like, even Jewish professionals who are saying, yeah, I work as a Jewish professional, that's my job, but really I'm a Burning Man person. And not even like I'm a Burning Man Jew, you know, Burning Man is my religion. And I do this Jewish stuff too. You know, I really like it. I care about it. But, you know, Burning Man is my religion. And I felt like, wow, we really have to talk about this. We really have to figure out what this means and how it connects to this Jewish stuff. And one kind of framing question that I have is what we really should be talking about, something along the lines of how understanding the power of Burning Man for those to whom it's powerful, that that could help us figure out how to reimagine Judaism or fix Judaism or however you want to talk about it. Or the other possibility is whether it's Burning Man or something else, and Burning Man just kind of is an example of it, I was thinking in terms of milk and honey, right? The Jewish presence at Burning Man, the Jewish camp at Burning Man, that maybe that's a great example in terms of what we've been talking about. I'm thinking about the conversation that we had with Jesse Dorogusker about Square, that the real sort of innovation is to realize that we don't have to do it all anymore. You know, that there may be other things that operate as the operating system, a metaphor that we've used before, and Judaism becomes an app, and it becomes a really powerful app. The people who are part of Milk and Honey at Burning Man love being part of Milk and Honey at Burning Man, but in a sense, I think that their primary, so to speak, identity is as Burning Man people, and that's okay, and maybe that's the future.
I'm thinking back to our episode with Casper and Angie, which we also spoke about with Joel Stanley, because to me, what this embodies, what Burning Man shows, is exactly as you just said, the ways in which people are finding religion, I mean, or at least some of the functions of religion, in theoretically secular or at least not religiously identifying organizations. I don't know, like, I'd be interested to bring back some of these folks and ask, like, is Burning Man secular? What do you think? Is it? That could be cool. But I'm thinking on a number of levels, because what Casper and Angie spoke about is that there are all sorts of organizations that are filling various religious functions, and that we may need to rethink how, whether it's our operating systems or our apps in the world, are working, so that we start to understand that, you know, those meaning goals and those belonging goals and all the things we've talked about, back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all that, like, sure, people are getting that in religion, but that's just one piece of the puzzle alongside all the others. And I think that what we can see in Burning Man is a microcosm of a much bigger picture, which is that, you know, other people, it's not Burning Man, but they're finding religion, even if they might not think of it that way, in their devout sports fandom, by being super intense Boston Red Sox fans and celebrating, you know, the calendar of their year through those events, even having life cycle events with their child's first game and you know, like, looking at when people retire and when they're inducted into the Hall of Fame as holidays, those kinds of things. And I could go on and on with all these examples, but I think Burning Man, what we heard from Joel and from Allie and from John, is that there are some specific parallels that we can gain from Burning Man and that we can reflect on today. But also there's this much bigger issue at play, which is that what we think of as religion or spirituality or meaning or community is way broader than what we might have at first thought.
Essentially, the question that I'm asking is, for those folks who feel passionately about Burning Man in a way that they don't feel as passionately about Judaism, and that's not necessarily our guess, but I think that there are a lot of Jewish people who go to Burning Man and feel a lot more passion for Burning Man than they do about Judaism. I mean, I've really not ever heard the kind of talk about high holiday services as this, you know, Jewish version of the annual pilgrimage, right? I haven't heard the kind of passion about high holiday services from as many people as I've heard that passion
that
for Judaism.
That tequila's gonna be dank.
You're right. So, like, the question, I guess the first level question that I want to ask is, if Judaism, understood more or less as an operating system that is maybe a little bit clunky today and could use a reboot, if Judaism wanted to learn from Burning Man, you know, what is it that seems to be working in Burning Man that doesn't seem to be working quite as well in Judaism? Or another way to put that question is, what seems to be working extremely well in Burning Man that's sort of tapping into basic human needs that maybe Judaism could enhance? You know, what's interesting is that in principle, right, there are things in Judaism that track some of these characteristics, right? There is the idea of the annual pilgrimage, right? We actually have three of them in Judaism, historically. And even in modern times, right, we have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that are kind of like these times when so many Jews come to synagogue, and it's kind of like a pilgrimage, except they're generally not having such a great time. We have something like Sukkot, which is a holiday that really, in theory, involves living in a tent in the elements, subject to the elements. And yet, for the most part, most people don't observe Sukkot at all. And for those who do, they're not really fully experiencing it in that way. And it sort of doesn't quite seem to be pressing the emotional buttons that Burning Man is. And so I guess I wonder at first is like, are we seeing, for example, that at least for many people, right, there is a deep yearning to have pilgrimage. There is a deep yearning to have pilgrimage with a community. There is a deep yearning to sort of experience this being in nature and subject to the elements for an extended period of time. And all of these are elements that once existed within Judaism, and then for very historical reasons, kind of were de-emphasized in European Ashkenazic Judaism for 1,000+ years, partly because it's too cold there to live in a tent, and partly for other reasons. They maybe didn't need a pilgrimage because we were kind of stuck in our small town and we couldn't really go anywhere anyway. And so there was no, these kind of things sort of fell out, but they actually were once in. The reason why they were once in is because they tap into fundamental human needs and human nature. And actually, a road to solution might be to fully recognize that we can bring those things back in a much more powerful way. But that would mean not having the sukkah be this thing in your backyard, you know, not having Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services be in the synagogue, you know, et cetera. What would that all look like if we took it seriously?
So I agree with you that Sukkot is not going as all out in most people's lives as something like Burning Man is, and it's a different kind of function. But I'm glad you brought it up, because one of the things I have gleaned from our guests is that part of the magic of Burning Man is that, sure, there's all sorts of things in a program that are happening in a given time. But like, by the sound of it, tons of people, or even the majority of people, are not doing those things. They're doing whatever they're doing. And that's like the right thing. Like, it's not that they are, you know, skipping class. Like, that's what it's about. Like, you're supposed to do whatever. And I think about, you know, in our Jewish communal context, like, there are certainly always that group of people kibitzing in the lobby, not participating in whatever thing is going on. But I think they think of themselves and the others think of them as skipping whatever it is. It's not that we say, oh yeah, that's like, you're doing it right. Like, the 25 of you that have had it with the first 100 minutes of Rosh Hashanah services and are now chilling in the lobby because you can't take it anymore, talking to each other and having a good time, probably. What if we said, that's like, you're doing it. Like, you're doing this gathering that we're supposed to, like, part of this whole purpose of Rosh Hashanah, in today's world at least, is a gathering moment. And like, maybe you're doing that better by kibitzing in the lobby than the people in the service. I don't know. I think there are pieces of the Rosh Hashanah service you could argue for. I like the shofar. I would do just the shofar and call it a day personally. I think that call works for me, whatever. But Sukkot, going back to it, I think Sukkot captures that in a way, because Sukkot doesn't have the rules and all the things you're supposed to do. Sukkot's just like, well, yeah, you make this sukkah, but then for a bunch of days, like, the correct thing is to sit in that sukkah and do anything. Like eating it, sleeping it, hang out, like, whatever the heck you do, like, that's correct. And I want that to become a bigger part of the fall holiday season, actually, because I think there's a really important human need being met there. Whereas I look at what's happening for the most part in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I'd want to like overhaul the whole process. Sukkot to me feels like it's actually in a healthy place for us to start to play with.
What if we completely reconceptualized Sukkot? You know, what if Sukkot became a Jewish Burning Man, where we actually created some kind of very analogous event that would be where people come from all over and they live in tents and, you know, they just be there for a week and do all kinds of things together, right? You know, they would invent what those things are. It feels to me like that is a much more powerful experience of what Sukkot is supposed to be getting at, right, which is a reenactment of that time that we lived in the wilderness during the wandering in the wilderness on the way from slavery to freedom, that, you know, I think you would get much more powerfully than having this kind of hut in your backyard, you know, right? But by the way, I think Sukkot is at the wrong time of year in America, and that's a really important issue, right? We've talked a lot about rescheduling the holidays, and it feels to me like in many parts of North America, if Sukkot is in October, you really can't live outside very, very well because it tends to rain and, you know, all kinds of... Now, some people don't mind that, but I think a lot of people do, right? As opposed to having this experience like Burning Man be more or less in the summer, more or less in a place that it doesn't rain and... or I don't think it rains there, not too much or whatever, right? It's in the desert. So... You know, by the way, the desert, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world to me that the, quote, right way to celebrate Sukkot for the 21st century in America, right, would be to have some mass gathering in the desert somewhere like August or September, you know. And by the way, that also then raises the question, perhaps it's actually, right, all the Jews that are going to Burning Man, like, I don't know if they've thought about this, and we didn't think to ask them about it, right? But essentially, you could see milk and honey at Burning Man as, like, a massive Sukkot observance.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, what I'd push on is that I think part of what the people we interviewed emphasized is that, sure, there's not rain, but, like, the fact of regular dust storms coming and totally wreaking havoc on the entire... place. It's miserable for a little bit, but also it seems like that is part of what makes the whole experience, is that there's this like deep hardship to deal with. So I'm on board, and I've said this in the past with other holidays, like I'd totally like create the working group that's going to do Sukkot in August and do it at Burning Man or whatever, and also do the group that thinks more actively about this and keeps it at the same time and like hopes for rain, because that's going to add somehow. And maybe they still do like a more massive experience than in the backyard. Maybe they still go somewhere where there's a bigger kind of gathering. But yeah, I think that there's a really good argument that what they're doing is already like a great embodiment of some of the goals of Sukkot, for sure.
In the case of Burning Man, right, I'm really seeing, and we discussed this with our guests, to some extent, right, the human need for pilgrimage, right? And I know Casper and Angie talked about this a little bit on that episode. I've heard them talk about having this conversation with certain folks in various organizations that have big gatherings, you know, and they've said to them, hey, you're actually enacting the religious history of pilgrimage, right? And I'm trying to make this second order statement, which is that the religious history of pilgrimage comes from the human need for pilgrimage, right? The human desire to gather, which, by the way, is not a weekly desire. It is a annual or biannual, you know, semi-annual or whatever desire. It's to have a huge gathering. And if you believe that the function of the High Holidays is primarily to have a long service, right, with a lot of breastfeeding and atonement, then you say, well, you know, that's the primary goal. If you believe that the primary goal is the pilgrimage itself, the communal gathering itself, then I think you might really be willing to open up the question, can we be more flexible about the content, because we understand that the pilgrimage is so important.
What struck me about Burning Man is they're absolutely channeling the spirit of pilgrimage, but it's not just that they're getting a bunch of people in the desert for a pilgrimage and like go. It's that they kept on referring to these 10 principles that they share and that are at the core of Burning Man. And it's not just like a party. There's real work that people have put into this to figure out like, okay, what are those human needs that we're going to address here? What are we going to, in addition to, you know, one of them being mass freedom to sort of try all sorts of stuff, but like the fact of those values is really important, and those principles at the core. I want us to be, and we've talked about this before, this is not new, but like I want us to be thinking, why are we gathering? So if in Burning Man's case, it's to bring people a sense of of meaning, or maybe for some of them spirituality or something that will both give them a respite from what Joel Stanley referred to as like the default year, the rest of the year, and also hopefully affect the way they live and act throughout the rest of their years. If that's the Burning Man purpose, that seems like a pretty good purpose to me. And what's ours? What are our 10 principles? I don't think that on a localized level, most of our Jewish organizations could easily answer that for you. And I definitely don't think that on a broader level, non-Orthodox Jewish people could answer, like, what's the point of Judaism?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, so I think that where we are in that is that, you know, number one, there is a human desire to gather. And number two is the question of there would be even more of a desire to gather and more value to that gathering if the gathering had purpose.
Right, because the people going to Burning Man, they absolutely want... They are fulfilling that human need for gathering, but they could have chosen all sorts of other ways, just like you talked about, the big conferences. My fiance was just at her annual statistical meeting with like 10,000 statisticians in Baltimore, Maryland. I feel like if statisticians do this, Jewish educators do this, everybody does this in some form. But the people at Burning Man, they may be choosing that over whatever their field's annual thing is or something. They've chosen this set of values and people and experiences for the gathering. Some people are choosing the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur experience for a variety of reasons for a gathering. It wouldn't, if that were my only experience to get at that need for like a big communal space or gathering, I would not feel like I achieved that goal. I would feel like my life was missing something. And I don't say that to be mean to synagogues. I say it because the modality is not designed to really feel part of something bigger than yourself in a way that speaks to me. It feels mostly like a set of people oriented forward to the front of the room, not even looking at each other, not even sharing with each other that much. And so I would choose other forms of large-scale gathering, like a Burning Man, like something else.
So let me say this also in a very, I think, sort of a compassionate way towards current Judaism, right? There is a group of people who love those gatherings. You know, there is a group, and I know a lot of folks who they really love an experience that's front-facing and et cetera, et cetera, right? Now, I keep going back to this description that really hit me strongly from our conversation with Sholem Dean, where he talked about the people who leave ultra-Orthodoxy as being less the non-believers and more the creative folks, right? Because ultra-Orthodoxy is a system that doesn't really invite creativity. And so people who have the creative impulse don't really find that to be where their passions lie. And if the chips align in a certain way, they leave. So I'm thinking, okay, now, number one, when we look at something like Burning Man, it feels to me, and I may be like under describing here, and it could be interesting to, you know, fully flesh this out with folks, but it feels to me like there are at least sort of three major characteristics to the people that seem to have a huge passion for Burning Man. You know, it's people that are very creative, right, that love that kind of creative environment where anything goes and, you know, all kinds of, you know, crazy things can happen and it's just totally accepted, you know, and there's so, and that in the day to day of the rest of the year, you're kind of censored in your ability to fully live out that creative spirit. You know, number two, it's got to be people who like, or at least don't mind, right, living out in nature for a week in difficult conditions, right? That's where it would kind of break down for me, I think. And the third is that it's people who really, I think, love, you know, right, all things being equal, they would love to live in a society that was all about giving to one another, you know, as opposed to competition and markets and whatever, right? And that Burning Man really emphasizes this generosity. So it feels like, okay, so the people, and it seems like there are quite a lot of them that have those characteristics, like Burning Man really works for them and is their passion, right? You know, and I guess like my question is there a Judaism that could look like that? And then B, what about people more like me, right? Who, you know, maybe more cerebral, more like air conditioning, you know, et cetera. you know, what would a Burning Man look like for folks like me? And can Judaism have that? You know, so ultimately, I think there'd probably be a number of different expressions of Judaism, which is fine. But I guess the other way of kind of imagining it, for example, right, is that Judaism is an app that can run on any of those operating systems. So rather than trying to imagine that we need to, you know, invent five new versions of Judaism that work for the five different types of people who might have these gatherings, you know, it's sort of like, is maybe we could think of a Judaism that is relatively consistent, right? Relatively the same across the board, but plugs into those different things. So that Judaism can plug into Burning Man, it can plug into my cerebral air conditioned gathering, and it can plug into the statistician's gathering, you know, and it's a value add in all of those, but it doesn't imagine itself to be an operating system. It doesn't feel that once it discovers that it's not an operating system, it's somehow less than, you know, and I think that there's this part of the conversation and the fear that you hear expressed from the folks who kind of have made traditional forms of Judaism their primary experience is that if Judaism is not an operating system, it's not valuable. And therefore, there's this like insistence on, you know, and if it's an operating system, it can only be one way. And so it becomes sort of an insistence on saying, can we got to do something so that all these people will come back into this way. And I think that in this conversation, we've now revealed two alternatives to that, right? One is to recognize what people's passions really are and to reimagine a Judaism that looks like that. And number two is to reimagine Judaism that works more as an app and that can plug into different kinds of passions.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. And I think that we need to be figuring out what the different plug-in modalities. I'm thinking of like those little converters that take one kind of plug, like when you go to a foreign country or something and you have different outlets in the wall so that you can't use it. And you have like the converter thing that helps you take something that would otherwise plug into an American outlet in the wall and allows you to plug it into the European one. And it's like, I feel like what we're talking about is we need to have those things that allow certain elements of Judaism that might work most naturally in X environment to like be converted and then work in some other environment.
That's really interesting.
I do want to focus, since we just had these, I do want to think more about the Burning Man specific pieces that, cause look, you're totally right to represent the folks for whom like being outside for a week, is not gonna fit for them. But I do think that there are so many people who are into outdoor things and think that that's not what Judaism is, or maybe that it can be, but that's not what Judaism's offering. I think of a number of friends of mine who have said directly to me, like, to bring us back to High Holidays, I've gone to High Holiday services. They don't work for me. I go on, literally, this is a cousin of mine. I go up on a mountain every year on Rosh Hashanah. And I think maybe he says like one Hebrew phrase or something, or one prayer, or but mostly he's up on a mountain and that's his Rosh Hashanah. And he says that not only is that more fun, but like he actually gets at the teshuvah, the atonement, the introspection, that kind of thing. And I think that there is something about being outdoors. And I know I don't have the science to explain why this is, but whenever I've been outdoors and whenever a lot of people I know have been outdoors, it seems like these introspective moments, these like big conversations about the meaning of the world or of their own lives or emotion, like all of this stuff seems to pop up. I think one reason why people rave about camp is that you're outside and like that starts to happen. It's why people talk about finding God or other things in sunsets or sunrises or whatever. And like there seems to be something there. And I think in addition to the gathering piece, the fact of Burning Man's outsideness does help. And maybe there are, and we should recognize there are people for whom a week straight of that is not going to be right, for all the reasons you mentioned. But what if in our radical thinking, we figure out like, okay, where are the spots where we really want to get outside and maybe make sure that it's not an uncomfortable version of outside. Maybe we want to get at hardship in different ways than like rain or dust storms. But like, what is, when can we get outside and sort of soak in the human stuff that comes from being in that outdoor environment? Because I think that Burning Man, being outside, it would not be the same thing if it was a week long with all the same people, even with the free environment, if it were in a big old conference center. It wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It could probably be a great thing, and we could design things like that for people that don't want to be. But there is something about the outside elements that enhances some element of our experiences.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And again, I mean, I've sort of reminded us that one of the reasons I suspect that we don't have a lot of that in Judaism as we generally have received it is because, you know, for 1,000 years or something, what became the largest force in American Judaism, i.e. European Ashkenazic Judaism, was in a very cold place in the fall, you know, and it's not likely that you're going to develop an outside experience in that kind of place for the high holidays, you know, for an all day experience of atonement. So, you know, so that's what I want to point out is that there's nothing inherently contrary in Judaism about doing that. It's just that there are very historical reasons why that didn't happen. Now the question becomes, right, what do you do now? And that's the question. And how would you move from A to B? And sure, let's retain as much of the traditional practices as we can, because there are all kinds of ways in which those themselves have become important to Judaism over the years, or maybe have picked up other meanings and whatever. But, you know, let's be willing to not do things that seem like they're getting in the way of fundamentally what we want to do. We have to be willing to stop doing certain things. And again, I sort of ask people, like, you know, at a certain point, if anything in the world just keeps accumulating more and more, it just becomes too much. And people can't handle it. Their minds can't handle it. Some people can, the extraordinary people. And those are the people who look at the others and say, hey, well, I can do it. So probably you should be able to, too. And it's like most people are like, you know, I have limitations, limited time, limited mental space, whatever the limitations are. And I can't buy into your whole big thing. But I really would buy into it if it was smaller. So could we do that?
What I would say is, like, look, we are going to stop doing things. Even the people that are in this effort to retain everything, the reason they're so scared, the reason why they build so many fences and so many rules is because, like, naturally, even when humans are trying to preserve the past, you don't preserve all of it. This is what Ari Kelman said. Like, you can't actually replicate what's been received for hundreds and hundreds of years. Stuff changes, and often stuff gets eliminated. There's 1.5 million things that you and I and all of our listeners are unaware of, totally, that have never been written down, that were done by Jewish communities a couple thousand years ago, that just the archaeological fragments that we found happen to not be those ones. We can try and try and try to keep everything. But even if we do that, we're still going to stop doing, like, in 100 years, there's still going to be stuff people don't do. And so the question for me is not how do we save everything? It's, okay, are we going to let it just happen so that, like, oh, the stuff that gets lost, and the stuff that gets kept? Or are we going to actually say, oh, let's be thoughtful about this. Let's say, you know, we think these are the goals. We think these are ways to get, like, these are the things worth keeping, you know, and these aren't. And I'm much more satisfied with that, because then at least what happens in the future is done consciously and with some choice involved. I think the danger comes when you just preserve, and still whatever, like, it's just sort of a luck factor, whether the good things stick around or the bad things do. Cause, you know, there are dangers in markets too. We talk on the show, we talk about how if something's compelling and something's good, then it will catch on. Well, we can also point to moments in history where, like, great things haven't stuck. And if we want the things that are really worthwhile to stick, then we have to actually put effort into it, as opposed to just doing it for everything and losing the ability to distinguish the most important from the less.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I can't remember if I've talked about this before on the show, but for me, like, in my thinking mythologically, the role of the Messiah has been this myth that has actually enabled some of this work to happen, because it's really hard to just get rid of stuff that's been around for a long time. You feel like you're letting down history. But if you can say the Messiah will bring it back one day, then I think psychologically you're more able to say we can stop doing this because we're not stopping it forever. If the Messiah comes, you know, when the Messiah comes, we can do it again.
We have talked about this before, but what I think a new twist we can bring to this conversation relates back to one of our recent Dan and Lex episodes, where we talked about how the death of something today means a different thing. So Messiah is important for all the reasons you said, because some stuff actually in the past and in the present dies and is like not going to come back, and unless there is some crazy circumstance, which is symbolized by Messiah coming. What we spoke about, and the example was Jews in the Woods, this project I was a part of, like stuff can die and then in a few years or even a few decades, it can re-arise in today's world because we have the internet and stuff is still there for people to stumble on one day. And so what we get in, so you talked about study, like if we have a mode of preserving something without doing it all the time, which I would argue we should use that for a lot of rituals that we don't need to be doing with all of our time. It's possible that there will be eras. I'm not so like full of myself that I think I know eternally there is no purpose for certain elements of Jewish tradition that I and many people I know today don't find meaningful. But if we literally like Google Drive and store these things and like actually make sort of a memory bank of this stuff, and then people occasionally go back and look at it for reference, then it totally can come back. We should be excited about like figuring out those new ways of storing this stuff so that it can be meaningful in 300 years, and not so worried about, oh, there's going to be 250 where it's not.
Maybe that's an interesting sort of like transition back to the like maybe app perspective of Judaism with something like Burning Man. I remember that years ago, my wife said a really interesting thing where she said, you know, Judaism isn't a shirt that you put on once a week. It's the glasses that you put on in the morning through which you see the rest of the world. And yeah, you know, that's a powerful idea. And it strikes me as that's a version of the operating system notion. And it's a little bit different from an operating system, because it's not saying Judaism is the core of who you are. It's saying it's something that you're putting on in order to help you experience the world better all the time, like glasses. But then there's this other piece, right? And I'm not sure, you know, I guess really, again, the metaphor is the app. It's you know, I periodically make a decision to add this element to my experience. I don't know, is there like a clothes that we wear that are analogous to that? Like, I'm not sure. Maybe it's like sunglasses, you know, like sometimes we want to put them on and sometimes we don't want to put them on. When we do put them on, they don't do something on their own, right? They assist us in the experience of the world in a way that we're looking for at that moment.
Because I think both of us agree the jury is still out on whether we're in a project of turning Judaism into an app or like figuring out a new Jewish operating system. I mean, we've talked about how we're not sure what that is.
Although I'm more and more on team app.
Yeah, and I am too. But like I continue to think that there are a variety of possible futures for this. Like for me, the answer is like, let's make the shirts. Like let's design the proverbial shirts of Judaism. We're carrying this analogy like hilariously far, but I'm okay with it. Hopefully you are too, listeners. We should be thinking about what are the awesome shirts, the ones that like would be super viral if you posted them and everybody would want to share one, everybody would want to buy. Like, what are the shirts that actually people will just put on once every laundry load or even less frequently?
Well, Sarah Lefton used to design those, you know, one said,
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For those who don't remember, Sarah Lefton is the director of Bim Bam, and she got her start, or at least one of her early ventures was to create a bunch of cool Jewish shirts, Jewish related shirts. But once again, like, what can we design for the people that literally are going to just do Jewish once a year? And what did we design for people that are just going to do it once a month? And when I say design, I'm not saying like we're going to make a physical product. Maybe we will make some products, but like, what are people going to set aside 1 hour of their year to do Jewishly? And how do we make that hour? How do we not bemoan that like, ugh, there's like thousands of other hours that they're not using? Like, how do we make that 1 hour amazing? And I'll tell you, I don't think that the optimum 1 hour is 1 hour of Yom Kippur Kol Nidre services. I think that's currently the most common shirt that people are putting on once a year. I want a better shirt. That shirt can still exist, but we need better ones. And then, okay, so what are the glasses that, once again, glasses is not part of you, but you're putting it on every day? There are people operating that way, totally. And I see that through the people that are like on a daily basis on Facebook, like engaging with this and thinking about this. And also even people who aren't like entering into Jewish spaces, but who see the world in the glasses sense through a Jewish lens, just because they grew up deeply immersed in it or whatever. That's real. How do we make those glasses amazing? And then, you know, I think there may still be a need to think about, like, for the people that actually this is like the core of who they are, how do we make that core as special as possible? I think, as you've mentioned, that's like a very small and shrinking group, but it's still a group, and that's there too. So I like the shirts, I like the glasses. I don't think we have to commit to one is the short of it. That was a many minute way of saying let's do it all.
Is there an analogy that you can think of that in a different realm of life where this is the case? I mean, like, I'm kind of thinking about technology, right? And that there are people who are like computer nerds, you know, right? Who just their whole life is computers. And then there's people like us who use computers to fulfill other tasks that we have in life, right? It's very rare that I'm using a computer in order to do a computer thing. I'm using a computer in order to talk to you or record a podcast or look up something on the internet, you know. And to me, I guess like what I'm trying to say about those is that I actually find them both equally valuable, right? That it's not that my way of using a computer is somehow less full than the person's use of a computer who is dedicating their life to computer science. They're just two different ways to use technology, to use computers, that are both powerful in different ways. And I guess that's my aspiration for Judaism. I feel like there's too much of a sense with Judaism that there is a continuum of ways to, quote, use Judaism, and some are lesser than others.
I'm thinking about a college classroom, actually. I'm thinking of what a professor has to do in their classroom. Say you've got a large class, and in any given classroom, you have, you know, X percentage of people, maybe half, that are majoring in that field. If you're in a chemistry class, you've got a set of people who they're majoring in chemistry. The way they engage with chemistry for 4 years is going to totally impact what work they do in their life, possibly, and certainly in some indirect or direct way affect how they see the world. They're going to notice things that I don't notice because I didn't major in chemistry. So a professor has to realize that part of their job is to serve that cohort that's in their classroom. But most of the time, there's also a bunch of people in that classroom that it's the only chemistry class or one of the only chemistry classes. Maybe there's intermediate level. Maybe there's people that have taken like 3 or 4 chemistry classes but aren't majoring. And then there's the people that this is their only one ever. And I think a professor's job is also to figure out, okay, what is that person? How do I create something that they're going to walk away from this class? And they're not going to think about chemistry as they wake up in the morning and as they go to bed at night and as they walk around. But like, they'll see some news article and they'll question something because of something they learned in my class. Or they'll think, like, that's another job that a professor's doing. And then there's the people that, like, are never walking in to a chemistry class. And I think also a professor's job, and this is part of, like, where research, whatever, is, like, how do we reach people? How do we affect, like, the world of people out there to start to get, like, a little sense of How for the people that are never putting on the hat or the shirt or the glasses, how are they still going to like at least have it in their consciousness? And maybe that's an analogy that works, maybe it's not, but like, I think that that could help us figure some of this out.
No, I think it works. I would just make it a little even more powerfully, right? Like, I would be like less apologetic about the idea of the people that are only taking that one chemistry class, right? Because the strong way is to say this person might become president of the United States, right? And I want the president of the United States to have an understanding of chemistry, because I think that that's part of what makes you a good president for all kinds of reasons, right? This other person might become an English professor, but, you know, there are ways in which that they'll be able to better appreciate the way the world works, and, you know, through literature, if they also understand the way the work, right, through its fundamental natures and whatever, you know, I mean, there are ways to make that. And so that ultimately is, I think, like, just thinking forward is something that I want to kind of return to and think about, is just this idea that, look, I mean, there are sort of two dimensions here, right? Because sure, like, with chemistry, with computers, and with Judaism, there are going to be cases where people just are using it in a poor way. You know, I mean, we can all think of lots of people who, like, are so intimidated by a computer and don't even know how to do the most basic things. And it's like, you know, I wish they would spend a little more time learning it, because it's actually not that hard and it would really help their lives a lot. So,
or they know a lot and they're hacking people. Like, it could be either end of it. Like, that's where the knowledge could be, like, getting back to our knowledge chutzpah. Like, you can use the knowledge for bad.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. Right. There's the opposite. So, yeah. So, on both directions, there's places where you would say, like, this isn't good. Where at least I'm thinking about sort of something like Burning Man is it's not an either or, you know, back to the questions that we were raising at the beginning. You know, I'm thinking it's both and. The projects that I would be excited to see moving forward, right, are these sort of like radical reimaginations of Judaism that draw, in this case, from Burning Man. You know, I'd want to point out that it's not that we're saying that Burning Man is particularly distinct. I mean, we talked to Zach Lasker about yoga. We talked to Jay Michelson about Buddhism. And, you know, there are all kinds of other things that Jews are participating in and getting a lot out of, that we might ask this question, what would it look like to radically reimagine Judaism in a way that was really, really building on what is attracting people in those other things? And that is a really interesting pursuit. And the other one is to say, you know, it's part of being in the world today that people are pursue and experiment with all kinds of things and are going to devote their lives to all kinds of things. And that's good. We're not actually trying to create a Judaism that wins in that competition. We're actually trying to create a Judaism that is cross-platform, right? That is important no matter which one you choose. And in many ways, that may even be more exciting.
If you're out there listening and you have some thoughts about any of this, whether it's Burning Man directly or some of the other wild and crazy places we went, please be in touch. And that's how we always like to close. So the particular ways that you can do that are, first, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. You can also head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And as Dan mentioned at the top of the episode, you can also support us financially at judaismunbound.com/donate, either a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.